Welcome to iFormRx, where we explore the evidence that matters to ambulatory care pharmacy practice. My name is Stuart Haynes, Editor-in-Chief of iFormRx, and as part of our evidence-based medicine series, today we're talking about interpreting the primary literature and applying it to make better informed patient care decisions. Nearly all of us have had to take a course in research design and literature evaluation, and many of us continue to participate in journal clubs after graduation. But like any skill, it requires repeated practice and refinement. Indeed, new research methods and analytical techniques have emerged over the past decade that are now in common use, and it's important to hone and refine our literature evaluation skills. Joining me today are Timothy Gladwell from the University of Maryland Eastern Shore in bucolic Princess Anne, Maryland, and Evan Williams from Rosemond University in picturesque Henderson, Nevada. Dr. Williams and Dr. Gladwell wrote a commentary for iFormRx entitled 10 Pitfalls Every Clinician Should Avoid When Evaluating the Primary Literature. Now, also joining us is Ashley Johnson from the Jonathan M. Wainwright Memorial Walla Walla VA Medical Center in wonderful Walla Walla, Washington. In addition to serving as the peer reviewer for the iFormRx commentary, Dr. Johnson has written reviews and presented at national pharmacy conferences about evidence-based medicine and research design. So, Tim, Evan, Ashley, thank you for joining me today for the iFormRx podcast.
Thanks for having us, Stuart. It's a pleasure to be here.
Yes, thank you.
Thank you for having me, and I really was impressed in just a wealth of information that was included in the article authored by Tim and Evan.
Well, most health professionals have had some formal education regarding research design, literature evaluation, and evidence-based medicine principles. But in your commentary, you contend that formal instruction received in school isn't enough. Why?
So, Stuart, there in your intro, I think you hit a lot of the key points. Obviously, this is going to vary between different practitioners, different practice areas, but I think it's really difficult for students to gain an understanding that's beyond just the academic understanding of literature evaluation because they don't have the practice experience necessary. In general, when these principles are taught, you need to be able to link it to real-world examples to know how you're actually applying those things. The concepts themselves sometimes can be simple, but thinking that taking one or two classes in school comprehensively covered all the significant concepts and resulted in mastery of that material, it's just really not the case. And as you pointed out, the research methods have changed over time. There are a lot more non-inferiority trials that might not have been covered when a lot of these folks were in school. And so it requires constant updating of these skills to make sure that they're up to date.
Now, the first pitfall you warn about is interpreting a study that fails to produce a statistically significant result. Can you give us an example of a non-significant study result that may have perhaps been misinterpreted or misused? And what should clinicians do when they encounter a study that's inconclusive or when there may be a type 2 error?
Sure. So in the written commentary, just to back up a little bit, we discussed the fact that trials which fail to produce statistically significant results can really be interpreted in one of two ways. The first possible conclusion is there really is no true difference between the groups with regards to the specific intervention being tested. This is the appropriate interpretation to make when the trial was powered appropriately, but no significant difference was identified. On the other hand, the second possible conclusion is the results are inconclusive. This is the correct interpretation when no difference is found in the trial, but the study was not really adequately designed with sufficient power to be able to find a difference. And although this seems to be a fairly simple and straightforward concept, what we find is that some practitioners tend to assume that as long as the sample size for the trial was met, that the study was appropriately powered. Unfortunately, that's not always the case, since there are multiple factors that determine a study's power. Not only the sample size, but also what was the anticipated incident rate of the studied outcome, expected differences in outcome rates between the groups, the intended alpha level, and some other things. So I think it's good to go over some relevant examples that really illustrate this point. And the ones I'm going to talk about really focus on What are the appropriate treatment goals for patients with hypertension? This has been a hotly contested area of discussion over the last few years, ever since say JNC 8 came out and some of the other guidelines. So in the written commentary, we talk about the ACCORD blood pressure trial. Now, many people have probably heard about this, but this was a well-designed trial that investigated whether aggressive blood pressure treatment to a goal systolic blood pressure less than 120 was beneficial in reducing macrovascular event rates in type 2 diabetic patients compared to a more conservative goal of systolic blood pressure less than 40. And in this trial, they found no statistically significant difference between the groups in terms of the primary outcome. When it was published, this was immediately considered a landmark trial. Really has been used to change practice. Most hypertension guidelines now recommend the goal systolic blood pressure less than 140 as being the most appropriate goal for patients with diabetes, as opposed to a more aggressive or lower blood pressure goal. Now, however, as we continue in time, we recently had the SPRINT trial that was published. Very similar study design, but much larger in terms of sample size. And because ACCORD was based on diabetes patients, of course, SPRINT looked at non-diabetic patients, but they found a complete 180 reversal in terms of the outcomes. They found, in fact, the study was stopped early because of an overwhelming benefit of more aggressive lowering of systolic blood pressure in these patients. And with that new result from the SPRINT trial, some of us as clinicians are actually going back, taking a second look at the ACCORD blood pressure trial. There may have been some clues in the ACCORD trial that maybe it should have been considered inconclusive. First of all, it had lower than anticipated event rates, which really decreased its power. And there were some benefits in certain components of the primary outcome. Specifically, there was a significant reduction in stroke rates with aggressive blood pressure lowering in the patients who were treated to the goal blood pressure less than 120. This is one example. Even though the sample size was appropriate, a landmark study changed practice, we may need to relook at it because of some of those issues. Was it really no true difference between groups, or should we have considered that to be inconclusive? And carrying it just one step further, we're having similar debates now with regards to appropriate blood pressure goals for elderly patients. When JNC 8 came out in 2013, of course, many of the authors of that guideline recommended that the appropriate goal blood pressure for patients 60 and over be less than 150 as opposed to less than 140 that we usually think of for most patients. That was based entirely on the results of two randomized controlled trials, the JATOS and the VALOS trials. They were both well designed and they reported no benefit to more aggressive blood pressure lowering in elderly patients. But again, similar to ACCORD, they had lower than anticipated event rates and they were underpowered to detect a difference. So JNC 8 authors interpreted that as a lack of evidence to support a goal of a blood pressure less than 140 over 90. Others interpret this as inconclusive and argue that there is more potential for harm by relaxing the goal rather than keeping it at 140 over 90. So how do we address this? The first thing that you have to look at is, in a study that reports no statistical significance among the treatment groups, was the power appropriate? And you have to go beyond looking at just did they meet their sample size, but what were the anticipated incident rates? What was the minimum important clinical difference that they anticipated? And did they actually achieve their power? If they did achieve the power, then and there's no difference, then you can assume that there really is no true difference between the groups. If they didn't meet the power based on any of those factors, then you really need to consider it to be inconclusive and more follow-up needs to be done.
Well, the second pitfall you warn about is type 1 errors and the concept of alpha spending functions. So what is an alpha spending function, and how can clinicians avoid misinterpreting or misusing results that appear to be statistically significant?
Okay, that's a great question. So alpha spending function is what I'd like to think of as sort of a fancy term for a fairly simple concept. I like to equate it when I'm working with students or residents to something most people can understand. So let's start by thinking of the alpha spending function as the allowance that many of us got as kids. So in statistical terms, the investigators are given an allowance that's equal to the total amount of the type 1 error they're allowed to have over the course of an entire trial. And just like with an allowance, the investigators can spend that in multiple ways. And most commonly, they spend it all at one time on one thing. So this is analogous to them having one primary outcome that the trial was powered to detect. They conduct the trial. At the end of the trial, they analyze the data, and as long as the resulting p-value is less than the alpha, they conclude that there's a difference between the groups. In essence, they spend all of their allowance or all of their alpha on one thing at one time. On the other hand, there are alternative ways that the investigators can spend their alpha or allowance, but each of these does have some statistical consequences. One other way they can do it is to spread their allowance or their alpha spending around on multiple different things. So this would be analogous to having multiple different endpoints, including lots of secondary outcomes. If we assume that for each of those outcomes, we have a 5% chance of committing a type 1 error, then the overall chance of committing an error grows exponentially with each outcome that's investigated. And one method of preventing this from occurring is that the investigators can reduce their alpha level to account for that increased number of outcomes. What that means is that as a result, when they look at the data, it would not be considered statistically significant unless the p-value for each outcome is, for example, less than 0.01 rather than the original alpha of 0.05. Great example of this was in the landmark trial that was done back in the late 90s called the Evaluation of Losartan in the Elderly Trial or the ELITE Trial. This was a comparison of the angiotensin receptor blocker Losartan versus the ACE inhibitor captopril in elderly patients with heart failure. So ARBs had just come on the market at the time. Many people felt that they were going to surpass the use of ACE inhibitors in patients with heart failure because they had lots of potential advantages. And so when the ELITE trial was done, the primary outcome that they looked at in this trial was incidence of renal dysfunction. It was not looking at some of the hard outcomes like cardiovascular adverse events. So they found in that trial, even though it was fairly well designed, had a fairly large number of patients, there was no difference in the primary outcome. But as part of the protocol for that study, they had multiple different secondary outcomes, one of which was all-cause mortality. And they did find a statistically significant benefit in that secondary outcome of all-cause mortality. The p-value, I think, was somewhere around 0.035. But one interesting thing that they mentioned in the methods, which many of us just kind of blew right through as we're trying to get to the results of the study, was they mentioned that there were no adjustments made for the multiplicity of all the different endpoints they looked at. I think they had somewhere around a dozen or more outcomes that they investigated, and that all of the p-values were unadjusted p-values, which meant that they never made adjustments for that alpha spending function. They assumed everything was 0.05, and if they found a difference, it was statistically significant regardless of how they spread the alpha around. This is a great example of where we can go wrong with the type 1 error rates by not addressing that alpha spending function, because they later followed that up with a much larger study called the ELITE 2 trial, which was designed specifically to look at all-cause mortality, and it actually completely contradicted the outcomes of the ELITE 1 trial. They found no benefit to the ARB in terms of mortality. In fact, the trend was towards the ACE inhibitor being better. So it was a great example of identifying a true type 1 error in an early trial. The other implication of alpha spending function, going back to my allowance analogy, is that you could also put something on credit. So in other words, if you want to look at the data from an investigator standpoint multiple times throughout the trial, you can have early access to that data. But again, there's a consequence. You have to use some of your alpha and spend it sort of as a finance charge when you're doing interim analyses, even if you're only looking at one particular outcome. So as the investigators look at the data multiple times throughout the course of a trial, they have to reduce their alpha level to keep the overall type 1 error rate consistent by the end of the trial. And typically what's done is that when they get to the end of the trial, instead of having an alpha level of 0.05, for instance, they'll marginally reduce it and say that the primary outcome won't be statistically significant unless it's less than 0.047, 0.048, or something like that based on the number of interim analysis they do. So in the written commentary, I use the example of the Miracle trial. This was a study of high-intensity atorvastatin 80 milligrams a day, started very early in the hospital in a patient who presents with an acute coronary syndrome. And the investigators were trying to identify whether early initiation of high-intensity statin therapy was going to be beneficial on long-term cardiovascular outcomes in these patients. And what they found was they did several different interim analyses, and they did adjust their alpha level downward. At the end of the trial, the p-value was somewhere around 0.047, where their alpha level that had been adjusted was p equals 0.48. So they did conclude that there was a statistically significant benefit, although it was sort of marginal, and the confidence interval reached one, so it didn't necessarily exclude the possibility that there was no benefit. But there were some commentaries surrounding that trial that sort of implicated that the investigators had conducted another unplanned interim analysis, and they should have adjusted their alpha level downward. If that had been done, that result would no longer have been statistically significant, even marginally. So those examples really illustrate some of the problems with the alpha spending function, and clinicians really have to take a look at, are they adjusting for multiple outcomes, and are they adjusting based on multiple looks at the same data to make sure that you don't inadvertently accept a result that may not be a true difference between groups.
Well, the third pitfall you warn about is the use of an active comparator in randomized control trials. Now, it's hard to argue against the use of active comparators, but you caution clinicians to read these studies with a jaundiced eye. Why?
So I think it's important to distinguish between an active comparator and whether or not that's actually an active comparator. The example we provide in the commentary looks at the phase 3 trials for direct oral anticoagulants, and they're getting compared in non-valvular AFib against warfarin titrated in INR between 2 and 3, which on the surface looks perfect. It's exactly what we would try to do. But we need to keep in mind how good we are at doing that. And when we have post hoc analyses looking at these studies, the tighter we were able to control the warfarin and keep that time in therapeutic range high, the smaller the differences were that we found between the DOACs and warfarin. That's just one example. This happens in other things too. We can look at the ACCOMPLISH trial, which was another example. In the ACCOMPLISH trial, they were looking to try to compare amlodipine to hydrochlorothiazide against a background therapy of benazepril. Maybe hydrochlorothiazide wasn't the best comparator. Maybe you should have used chlorthalidone, just because that's where we have probably more evidence. You could even look into like the PARADIGM study. There are letters to the editor saying that the use of enalapril 10 twice a day as a comparator might have not been the most appropriate comparator versus an ARB or maybe a different dose of enalapril. Now, the PARADIGM trial went on to impact, they changed the guidelines based on this study. So it's not saying that the comparator was ineffective or negates the results of the study, but looking at that allows you to gather a more complete understanding of what actually occurred. And so it's important to dive a little bit deeper into the doses, the drug selection, the quality of care your comparator group was receiving.
I would also also add, so seeing if the investigators allowed the use of rescue medications, and analyzing a few studies looking at diabetes medications, it's also important to see if that's the standard of care, and also if the use of rescue medications is similar between groups.
The fourth pitfall is near and dear to my heart. In practice, we often rely on surrogate markers to make patient management decisions. For example, we use blood pressure and blood glucose to guide treatment. But surrogate markers can mislead us. In clinical research, patient-oriented evidence that matters is what really matters. Can you give us some examples where surrogate markers used in clinical trials led us astray?
So again, in our commentary, we give an example out of 1980s cardiology. We were using surrogate markers in most of these earlier studies looking at preventricular contractions, and we were associating that with reductions in mortality. And unfortunately, that probably resulted in thousands of deaths until we had the results of the CAS trial saying that the way we were using them, these antiarrhythmic drugs, it was probably not the best practice. A more current example you might think about, maybe not more current, but certainly longstanding example, would be how we've been treating lipids for the last several decades. We've known since the early 90s that statin drugs are excellent for secondary prevention. And as more studies came out, we found, you know, higher doses were generally associated with lower mortality rates. But none of them were looking for a primary outcome of reducing your LDL to a certain level. Yet, our guidelines for decades were trying to give LDL goals that they were shooting for. We had combinations of statins with fibrates, niacin, and we generally try to avoid these combinations now because subsequent studies have shown there's not really any mortality benefit to doing this. And really, that was all in an effort to get this surrogate marker, this LDL, to a certain goal.
Also that comes to mind is the use of bevacizumab for metastatic breast cancer. That was initially approved. It received accelerated approval back in 2008 based on the use of what I like to call as a composite enriched and surrogate outcome, which was progression-free survival, which contained two endpoints, time till death and also time until growth of the tumor size. So based on improvement in progression-free survival, it was granted accelerated approval. It did not demonstrate a significant improvement in overall survival, but again, this was a preliminary study. And typically, accelerated approvals are based on surrogate outcomes. And I think there's some benefits to using surrogate outcomes. It does allow us to conduct clinical trials more efficiently, but further studies actually showed that the improvement in progression-free survival was not as robust in subsequent studies. And of course, there's some significant safety concerns with the use of bevacizumab. And so ultimately, its approval was revoked for metastatic breast cancer in 2011. So I think a couple of takeaways there. One is if you're looking at a composite outcome and their surrogate components, look to see what's really driving the treatment effect. Is it the surrogate component or is it the clinical outcome? Oftentimes it is that surrogate component. Also, particularly in oncology studies and even in other fields of study, you can also see as a reader if there are any validation studies. So you may find that using statistical analyses, looking at an individual trial and also looking at multiple trials using regression analysis can also give us a better insight if there's a certain change in a surrogate outcome that correlates or that demonstrates a change in the desired clinical or patient-important outcome. So that's another tip that I also like to use as well.
In your fifth pitfall, you warn about relying on observational studies like case control and cohort studies to make patient management decisions. Why?
Well, as most of us learn in school, there is a generally accepted hierarchy to the levels of evidence provided by different study designs. So for the most part, well-designed systematic reviews and randomized controlled trials are considered to provide the highest level of evidence to inform many patient care decisions. Other study designs, such as the cohort studies and case control studies, they may be useful for answering specific types of questions, but clinicians should always be careful when interpreting the results because there's a possibility of confounding issues, and they're really not designed to provide a true cause and effect relationship that the randomized controlled trials will really help us answer. And there are multiple examples in the literature where a highly cited article that utilized a cohort or case control study design reported a benefit with a particular intervention that was later contradicted by a well-designed randomized controlled trial. And I could throw out numerous different examples of vitamin E intake on cancer risks and omega-3 fatty acid intake and cardiovascular disease. But the classic example and the one we used in the written commentary is on the use of hormone replacement therapy to try to reduce the risk of cardiovascular disease in postmenopausal women. One of the early studies, the Nurses Health Study, was a very large prospective cohort study. I think it followed over 120,000 patients over about 10 years. And they reported a beneficial effect of using hormone replacement therapy on reducing the risk of cardiovascular disease in these patients. But later studies that investigated this hypothesis, including the HERS trial and the Women's Health Initiative, that were well-designed randomized controlled trials, largely refuted that finding. And nowadays, hormone replacement therapy, as we all know, is not routinely recommended except in the case of menopausal symptoms. So you always have to be skeptical of even those highly cited articles that have the cohort or case control or non-randomized designs, because they are not really designed to answer a lot of the questions that we need to know as practicing clinicians.
And I would also just echo that there's so many variables that they don't take into account that you would have in a prospective randomized controlled trial.
Pitfall number 6 is about subgroup and post-hoc analyses, and this type of analysis is often performed and included in the published results, but you warn against putting too much stock into these findings. Why?
So that really comes down mostly to study design and power. The researchers hopefully designed the study and powered the study to identify if a difference exists or doesn't exist for their primary outcome. And while the subgroups might help clarify some of the findings or maybe hint at reasons why the findings came out the way they were, they really just need to be hypothesis generating. It's just an ancillary finding. As Tim pointed out earlier, you know, the risk of type 1 error increases as you do these oftentimes. The risk of type 2 error is higher because you are generally underpowered to find the difference you're looking for when you run these subgroup and post hoc analyses.
And I would add to that, I think it's also helpful to take a look to see if the subgroup analyses are pre-planned. And this can sometimes be difficult to determine, but some tips that I've learned along the way is to actually compare the published protocol, if you can find it, or even the protocol that's listed on a clinical trial registry, such as clinicaltrials.gov, and compare that with the published results. Because, of course, the concern there would be that if those results weren't, or if the subgroups weren't planned ahead of time and then were created based on what they found, there could be an element of bias that's introduced in evaluating those results.
Interpreting the results of studies that are terminated early is something you warn about in pitfall number 7. And clearly there are legitimate ethical reasons to stop clinical trials early, but you warn against getting overly excited about short-term findings. Why?
Well, Stuart, you're absolutely right. There's often multiple legitimate reasons for stopping a study early, whether it's because of overwhelming evidence of beneficial effects or an unexpectedly high rate of serious adverse outcomes. In those cases, there's an ethical mandate, basically, to terminate a trial and treat the study patients accordingly. But that decision always has to be balanced against a couple of other issues that may arise once the study is stopped prematurely. The first is that there's going to be a permanent loss of data that will occur compared to what would have been obtained had the trial continued to its originally planned conclusion. Once you have a large clinical trial that's been designed to test a specific hypothesis and it gets stopped prematurely, it's unlikely anyone will ever go back and repeat that study or try to replicate it. So you'll never know if one or more of the outcomes may have been different had the trial continued. And even if the termination was justified based on a benefit that you found in the primary outcome, the loss of long-term safety data from the trial may also be important. Another issue with early termination of a trial, though, is a concept that's known as regression to the mean. And this is a real phenomenon that's been identified in many large clinical trials. And basically, it involves the observation that initial differences that you may observe between treatment groups may appear large and statistically significant early on in the course of a trial, but those early differences often become much smaller or they completely disappear as the trial approaches its completion date. So in other words, the outcomes for the two treatment groups originally start very far apart, but they converge over time. And that's where the phrase regression to the mean comes from. And a great example of this we highlighted in the written commentary is the LIGHT trial that was recently published in JAMA. This was a cardiovascular outcome study designed to evaluate the safety of the combination of naltrexone and bupropion for treatment of obesity. And at the first interim analysis, when approximately 25% of the patients had been enrolled, the data suggested that a combination of naltrexone and bupropion was associated with about a 40% reduction in cardiovascular event rates compared to placebo. This was an unexpected finding, but despite this apparent benefit, it didn't meet the pre-specified rules for stopping the study, and enrollment in the trial actually continued. Unfortunately, there were some technical issues that occurred where the manufacturer allegedly breached confidentiality of the data from that interim analysis, and the investigators decided on their own to stop the study due to concerns over bias in the trial. By that time, though, the results were available for approximately 60% of the planned sample. And that initial benefit that they found with the combination of naltrexone and bupropion, the 40% reduction that they found in cardiovascular rates during that first interim analysis, it had completely disappeared by the time they had enrolled approximately 60% of the patients. So that really highlights the rationale for having clearly defined stopping boundaries in a trial, because had this study been stopped at the first interim analysis based on that initial statistically significant result, all of us might have been recommending this combination product for every one of our overweight and obese patients as a method for reducing cardiovascular risk, when in fact, it really would have been just a type 1 error, and there probably is no benefit to this combination.
The big thing that comes to mind when I'm looking at trials that have been stopped early is the evidence that was shared in two systematic reviews, which were termed the Stop at 1 and Stop at 2 reviews. And overwhelmingly, these reviews found when looking at trials that had been stopped early in the Stop at 1 review, and then trials that were stopped early compared to those trials that were not, also called non-truncated studies, found that the risk of overestimating the treatment effect is much more pronounced in trials that are stopped early. And along with that, trials that have fewer than 200 events compiled in the study have the highest risk for overestimating those treatment effects. So a couple of things that I think are helpful to look for as a reader are, one, to see if they're adhering to consort reporting. So there's a couple things that consort does recommend that be included in a publication for a trial that's been stopped early. And oftentimes you may not find this. So there should be the planned sample size that was initially suggested by the Data Safety and Monitoring Board, the interim analysis after which the trial was stopped, if there was a use of a stopping rule, and if there lastly was an adjusted analysis that accounted for that interim monitoring, as was previously alluded, accounting or adjusting for that potential alpha error, because again, we're taking multiple looks at the data, so we need to make sure that we're not increasing our risk for finding a significant difference when in fact one doesn't really exist. One thing as a reader, you may not find all this information in the published final manuscript. So it may require you to go back to the protocol, supplementary appendices that are on the journal website, also on clinical trial registries. But those would be really helpful pieces of information to obtain to see, you know, was the stopping of the trial from your viewpoint and what you could gather really appropriate and warranted.
In pitfall number 8, you point out that declaring the findings of a study to be clinically meaningful or clinically important is inherently subjective. Does this mean that interpreting the results of a clinical trial is really a matter of opinion?
Well, to some extent, yes. The results of the trials that those are more or less objective. Either there was a difference or there wasn't. But really taking it that second step and determining how practice should change as a result, that requires significantly more nuance, and that is subject to opinion. I brought up the Improve It trial in the commentary, where they needed a very, very large sample size to show a very small difference statistically. And when you're trying to determine the clinical importance of such a small difference, you really got to take a look at how much effort they had to put in to find that difference. That difference may truly exist, but are you going to incorporate that into your practice? You can consider like the ADVANCE trial, which may be interpreted as suggesting that an A1C target of 6.5 might reduce microvascular and macrovascular complications. When you inspect that a little bit closer, you find that the driver of that composite endpoint was microvascular issues, and specifically nephropathy, and there was no reduction in combined macrovascular outcomes at all. Also, there was an associated increase in severe hypoglycemia and hospitalizations, but not mortality as we saw in the ACCORD trial. So as a clinician, what do you do? Do you shoot for that goal of 6.5% to try to save kidneys, or are you trying to prevent hypoglycemic events and shoot for a slightly higher goal? These differences even make their way into guidelines. When you look at the ADA recommendations versus the AACE recommendations, they say for most patients, either you're going to go with 7% or 6.5% respectively. The point is that some of the interpretation is up to opinion, especially when it trickles down to you making it a treatment decision for the patient that's right in front of you.
Completely agree. And obviously, it would be a lot easier for us if it was black and white and clear cut. I'm sure when I say this, it'll be coming back in waves of, oh, yes, I remember this from my time in school or in residency. But statistical significance does not always equate with clinical importance. I think sometimes we get kind of tunnel vision with looking at p-values, and so we kind of miss out on really the valuable information that can be gained from looking at the treatment effects. I think it is also important when you're looking at a single trial to not evaluate it in a silo, but also take into consideration the other available evidence, what sort of treatment effects are demonstrated with other available therapies. I also would, strongly encourage that when you're looking at the primary outcome, to see how that boils down to an absolute risk reduction as opposed to just a relative risk. And even, typically we only want to calculate a number needed to treat if there's actually a statistically significant result found. But also giving that as some benchmark to look at and see, if I'm going to need to treat 300 patients, is that really worth it? And what are the trade-offs? And, what are the adverse events that are emerging? Are they rare but significant? Are they common and potentially limit the use of an intervention in a patient population?
So pitfall number 9 warns us about dropouts and how the data from individual subjects enrolled in a study should be handled. Tell us a bit more about that.
Sure. Well, that's kind of an open-ended discussion, but let me start by talking a little bit about what I think most clinicians are familiar with in terms of how investigators handle the data. And that has to do with the intention to treat analysis versus a per protocol analysis. So each of these has its own particular advantages and disadvantages, and the choice of methods may actually produce different results and conclusions. So just going back over what each of those is, intention to treat analysis really looks at the data for a patient according to that patient's original assignment group. Doesn't matter whether the patient completed study, adhered to the protocol, or even took even one dose of the study medication. If you're using intention to treat analysis, that patient's going to be analyzed according to how they were originally assigned. We usually think of that as a more conservative efficacy analysis because it takes into account the fact that most of our patients in the real world are probably going to have some non-adherence to the treatments. When we look at the other way to analyze data, the per protocol analysis, that really interprets the results only for those patients who complete the study according to the protocol. So it really gives insight into how this intervention would fare in ideal circumstances, but it's not really going to reflect the results that you would expect in real clinical practice. And in the commentary, we give the example of a recently reported study called the Inquiring About Tolerance Study that really illustrates the difference between these two methods of analyzing the data for how patients are handled in the study. So without going into too much detail about the protocol design, the trial was really investigating the effects of early introduction of allergenic foods on the development of food allergies in children. When they analyzed the results according to the ITT, or intention to treat principles, there was no statistically significant benefit observed in introducing these allergenic foods early on and trying to reduce the incidence of food allergies. On the other hand, though, when the investigators analyzed those same results according to the per protocol analysis, there was a statistically significant benefit, and it favored those patients who adhered to the prescribed regimen and got the early introduced allergenic foods. It really did reduce the risk of food allergies. The issue with this is that some practitioners may be tempted to make an assumption that as long as a patient adheres to the treatment regimen, that that patient will get that observed benefit in whatever intervention it is. But as the authors of this EAT study suggest, there are some other things that could have occurred. Maybe a patient didn't adhere to the regimen because they developed early signs of an allergy that weren't necessarily documented, so they dropped out. So there could have been some issues that biased that outcome, and you can't always make the assumption that the per protocol analysis or the ITT analysis is going to be the correct one. We usually assume intention to treat is the better method for clinical drug trials, particularly for superiority trials. That may differ for other trial designs and under different circumstances. Going beyond just looking at those two methods, there are some other areas of handling individual patients that really lead to what I like to call gray areas in analysis of the data. So let me just throw out a couple of these for listeners to think about. What do you do if you have patients that completed the entire trial? They maybe contributed to some of the primary outcome event rates. And then at the end of the trial, the investigator goes back and looks and saw that they actually violated the protocol and they should have never been included in the first place because they were ineligible. They didn't meet the inclusion-exclusion criteria. Is it fair then to keep them in the analysis? Would it change the outcomes? And we've seen that in some trials. What about if you have a large clinical trial and a lot of patients cross over to the other treatment arm? We saw this in the AFFIRM trial where they looked at rate control versus rhythm control in patients with atrial fibrillation. Many of the patients who were originally in the antiarrhythmic treatment arm crossed over to rate control because the antiarrhythmics didn't work. Is it fair then to analyze the data for those particular patients according to their original assigned treatment group when in fact they may have only been on antiarrhythmics for a short period of time? Or is it better to eliminate them and try to identify the per protocol analysis adherent patients? And then the last example I'll throw out there is the use of run-in periods in many large clinical trials. A classic example is the U.S. Carvedilol heart failure study. They actually had a run-in period as a safety issue just to make sure the patients could tolerate the drug before they ever got assigned to different treatment arms and were randomized into the trial. Unfortunately, many of those patients in that run-in period did not tolerate the treatment and had worsening heart failure, and some of them even died. The investigators chose to exclude all of those patients from the final analysis. So when they did that, that may be reasonable to do. But when you and I use carvedilol in practice, we have to be very cautious that some patients are not going to tolerate it. So the results they found and reported in the U.S. carvedilol study may have actually been exaggerated because we know in clinical practice there are certain patients that are not going to tolerate beta blockers right off the bat.
I do think it's helpful to take a look at how they're actually defining per protocol and intention to treat. You may find that there's some nuances and qualifiers that are unique to a study. There may be requirements for adherence with the study medication or so forth. And then particularly with non-inferiority trials, you may find that there's quite a different way. So there may be a modified intention to treat analysis. So it's helpful to carefully read those and see who actually is included in the analysis. Along with that, and looking at non-inferiority trials, the difference between ITT and per protocol is almost reverse of what you would think with the superiority study, in that the results may actually be more conservative for the per protocol analysis, because you're wanting to make sure that if there is a difference between the two, that we're detecting that and not just inaccurately concluding that they are similar by a predefined margin.
Your last pitfall, pitfall number 10, warns about publication bias, data manipulation, and statistical errors. How common are these problems, and is there really anything that we can do as readers to minimize or mitigate these problems?
Absolutely. So when we were constructing this commentary and thinking about the 10 points we wanted to talk about, obviously there were more things that we could have put in here, but I think we intentionally decided to list this as our last point for one simple reason. That is, even the most seasoned clinicians who are well-versed in literature evaluation may not be able to recognize these issues because they're extremely difficult to detect. Unfortunately, the research into these problems suggests that they are fairly common. Some authors have suggested statistical errors in up to 15 to 20% of publications, and that even up to 10% of publications may have incorrect results based on those statistical errors. And you mentioned publication bias. That's another major issue. It's always been general consensus that studies with positive results are more likely to be published than those with inconclusive or negative results. But some recent analysis really hit home with the scope of this problem. The one that we listed in the written commentary focuses on the issue of exaggerated benefits and publication bias from the literature on antidepressants. And this was really an eye-opener for me when I came across this article. The authors reviewed clinical trial data that had been submitted to the FDA through clinicaltrials.gov. The authors then looked at that data and compared it to actual publication data. So tried to identify whether there was a discrepancy in what was sent to the FDA versus what was actually in the published literature that most of us have access to. And what they found was pretty remarkable, that overall 97% of the positive trials that were sent to the FDA were published. Not surprisingly, but 92% of the negative or inconclusive trials were either not published at all, or at least they couldn't find them, or they were published in some manner that suggested a more positive benefit than what had originally been sent to the clinicaltrials.gov site. So if a clinician is not aware of the lack of balance in that reporting, he or she may assume that the benefit of antidepressants will be much higher than the actual results. That doesn't even get into the issues of just clearly falsified data, and we know that there's been some of that out there. So they're very difficult to detect. They're probably not uncommon, and you always have to keep a healthy skepticism in the back of your mind whenever you're reviewing any published data.
I think this is a perfect bookend for the 10 caveats that we're looking at with examining clinical evidence. And really, this has been a hot topic, not just in the U.S., but globally, with multiple organizations calling for transparency of the evidence that's available in healthcare research, from the FDA and the All Trials Campaign, which some of you may be familiar, which is an initiative that is really calling for all trials to be registered, for them to all provide summary results within 1 year after trial completion, to provide a full report of the trial methods and results, and also to allow access to raw individual patient data. We've been talking about just a single isolated trial in a lot of these examples, but this information is then used and aggregated oftentimes within a meta-analysis to provide us with further information on treatment effects for different interventions, not only from the efficacy standpoint of data, but also safety. people are really wanting access to that to make sure that we have a clear understanding of what potential issues are arising that perhaps right now as readers we're not privy to, that allows us to have a more informed risk-benefit profile when discussing options with our patients.
Tim, Evan, Ashley, I want to thank you for your insights and helpful advice. You rightfully point out that every research study must be interpreted with due caution. Indeed, nearly every study has caveats or pitfalls that we must pay attention to, and the results of any single research study are rarely, if ever, conclusive and irrefutable. This is not to say that research findings shouldn't inform our practice, or that all evidence is hopelessly flawed. Rather, we should be mindful of its limitations. The weight of the evidence, data that is collected over time using different methods, and findings replicated by different investigators should increase our confidence. Well, thank you for joining us for this special edition of the iFormRx podcast. This is Stuart Haynes, editor-in-chief of iFormRx, signing off.